Obviously, there's something lost in any sport when you're watching it on television. But tennis, you really, really don't get it unless you've actually watching it. And that somehow the foreshortening of the screen, you don't get that the pace is changing all the time and that there's different spins on the ball every time. It just looks like Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic are hitting the backhands back and forth to each other. It's way more complicated than that.
Everyone, John Wertheim here. It's this week's Beyond the Baseline Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. We have a special guest this week. It's an in-studio guest who's actually gracing us with his physical presence. Not often we have that, especially since we moved from Midtown Manhattan down to the Wall Street area. The guest this week, Jerry Maserati. For a long time, he was the editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine that everybody reads. He's also a founding editor of Play, the New York Times sports magazine, and in his mid-50s, he decided to try something new and play tennis. Not recreationally, necessarily. He wanted to get really, really good. He did that, and his writing about this experience is Late to the Ball. It is an excellent, I don't even know what to call this. It's part memoir, it's part sports book, and it's a lot of social science about getting old. It's a terrific read. It's really elegantly written. Very well-crafted book that I encourage everybody to read. There was an adaptation in the New York Times Week in Review section that we will link on the site. That it's a terrific read that will give you a sample of the book. But we really enjoyed talking, really enjoyed having him down here, and we'll welcome him now. Jerry Maserati, welcome to the podcast Hubble at Sports Illustrated.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Is this your first podcast? Did
it
I hear correctly?
It is. This is my first podcast. I'm very excited.
At the end, you'll have to fill out a brief survey.
Okay.
We'll get some bonus miles. So,
okay.
Congrats on the book.
Thank you.
Late to the Ball. I guess I'll start here. Is this a tennis book?
It is in part a tennis book. It is also a book about aging, and specifically, I think, about late middle age and that moment that your career is winding down, and if you have kids, the nest is emptying, and sort of what do you do with your life? And you're in a different place maybe than your dad or your granddad was. You're a little healthier. You didn't smoke. You have a little more energy. And what are you going to do with that time?
In this audio medium, people can't see this, but you do not look like someone who is in retirement age with two kids out of the house. But no, I mean, this is, seems to me it's part memoir, part meditation on time.
Yeah.
Did you expect this going in? I mean, did you sort of expect the tennis to be, I don't want to say a conceit, but the tennis was almost a vehicle for you to explore some of the social science and some of this geriatric research? Did that sneak up on you, or was that your intent?
Well, the intent actually was I had read a book. Well, let me step back one step. It was one of the first experiences in my life that I actually kept a diary. I don't know why I was never a diary keeper, but when I started taking tennis lessons, I began writing, not in any sort of psychologically dense or emotionally, in an emotional way, but I said, well, this is what I did today. My forehand was a little deeper. My volleys were a little crisper or not. Then I read a book by Leanne Chapton. It was a book about being a novice. It was a memoir about being a serious swimmer in her teens and trying out for the Canadian Olympic team. And I thought, there's a lot that she's going through that's not what I'm going through, but there's a lot that is. This whole idea of being a novice and being a novice in your late 50s. And that was really the germ of the book. Like, it seems like a new experience. It's probably an experience that a lot of people of my generation are having, but probably an experience that a lot of people of previous generations didn't have. So that was the germ of the book.
I don't want to give away too much, but in your mid-50s, you take up tennis, and you are a novice, as you say, and really break down the task, but you get quite good.
Yeah, I get good. I get good enough to be a decent club player.
Yeah, playing tournaments?
Yeah, I play in tournaments. I lose. And certainly in doubles, I'm able to stay on the court in most of these tournaments. That sort of playing at that level for me is more about measuring how good I've gotten. And actually just enjoying the company of the people who I get to meet at these tournaments. And actually one of the byproducts I didn't expect when I got into this is there's a kind of male friendship that I think a lot of guys experience when they're on their high school, sports teams. And they're not the deep friendships necessarily that you have at that time, but there's something about that kind of buddiness that's different. And that's something that I've experienced in this whole process of playing on tennis teams and in senior leagues and that sort of stuff. These are people who don't ask you what you do the second question when they meet you. They're really, it seems superficial, but it's actually not. It's pretty, you're sharing in this, you're in a kind of guild where you're all trying to get a little better at your game.
You could have tied flies and you could have picked up the accordion and God knows golf. How'd you settle on tennis?
Well, golf would have been out because my wife and I sort of had a verbal prenup that there could be no golf because she thought it was basically parenting avoidance.
That should be enforceable in all 50 states. I commend your wife.
But tennis was always a game I loved to watch. Now, it is also true that I will watch almost anything. I was on an assignment writing about an Icelandic rock band 15 years ago and, got into curling for 3 days. And so I can really watch anything. But the tennis, it was always just, tennis struck me as something beautiful and complicated. And I loved watching it for that reason. And it also seemed difficult. And I was drawn to the difficulty of it. And in some ways, that insulated me psychologically from ever worrying about getting better, because there's only so good you could get at something that complicated.
It's hard as hell, isn't it? I mean, I think that's a real, people talk about, it's not telegenic, and where's LeBron James? And I think one of the core sort of growth stunters is just the fact that it's really hard.
It's really hard. And also, honestly, television, to me, obviously there's something lost in any sport when you're watching it on television, but tennis, you really, really don't get it unless you've actually watching it. And somehow the foreshortening of the screen, you don't get that the pace is changing all the time and that there's different spins on the ball every time. It just looks like Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic are hitting the backhands back and forth to each other. It's way more complicated than that, as you know, because you know the sport so well. I think I was drawn originally, though, that changes in the course of my playing. I was drawn to the solitude of it in the same way that I'm drawn to the solitude of reading and writing, which are the things I've basically done with my life. And that somehow the tennis seemed like solitude times 10, it's so gladiatorial. You're so on your own. There's no teammates to pick you up. There's nowhere to hide. Somehow that was appealing too, though I came to love doubles in the end.
Said that even in cage fighting, for one out of every 3 or 5 minutes, someone's patting you on the back and giving you instruction and water. Solitary confinement. All right, let's take a quick break real quick. I want to tell you about the NBA playoffs. They, of course, are in high gear. The second round has been so much better than the first round. Here at the SI Podcast Network, we are in high gear as well. We give you Hoop Fans, two great shows in one. First, there's Open Floor. You'll hear our man Lee Jenkins interview the most interesting personalities in basketball. Then in addition, young Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver sit down once a week at least. Last night, they were up after the Portland Golden State game, well into the infomercial hours. Sharp and Golliver break down the best storylines of the playoffs. The NBA playoffs are here. We're all waiting to see if Golden State can repeat or if Cleveland can have the city's first championship since the 1600s. Or thereabouts. Again, that's SI's NBA podcast. You can find it on iTunes, Google Play Music, or at si.com/podcasts. How'd you find the experience of writing about tennis to be? It's a weird sport to me to write about. How many ways can you describe Serena hit an ace?
But yeah, no, that's a challenge. And one of the other challenges I had in the book, I think, was trying to figure out at what. Who am I writing for? Someone who has never watched a tennis match, or am I writing for someone who is a tennis fanatic, and where do you find the sort of happy medium there? And I had a lot of help from my editor, Colin Harrison, on this too. But, you know, there were ways in which I just didn't want to slow down the book with explaining literally everything and hope that I could just convey what was going on.
There are, help me here, what are there, 55 chapters? 55? I mean, they're small. I mean, it's written,
yes.
I don't want to give away too much, but it's written in sort of elegant, maybe 4 or 5 page chapters. And it occurred to me there are about as many chapters as there are points in a set. Was this intentional, or am I overthinking this?
Oh my God, that is fantastic. No, I never imagined that. I wanted the book to move quickly. I wanted, you know, I imagined a book that someone could read in a weekend, not 2 weeks, and that would have this sort of propulsive force forward. For many years, I edited Michael Lewis, and Michael Lewis has this amazing ability to keep you going, and it just tumbles forward, and you get through the book quickly, and I love that about his writing. And I don't have that style. He does it with sentences, starting with dependent clauses and having those sentences tumble and tumble, and I don't have that sort of writing style, but I wanted that kind of pace. I wanted someone to feel that they weren't going to be bogged down by this book, and that really was what was behind the short chapters.
I assure you, no one will be bogged down by this book. No, I mean, I think it's a really, I couldn't tell if you got into tennis and realized that you could sort of insinuate all this other material. And I'm a sucker for any social science, so I thought that was really interesting. Tasks and handedness.
Yes. Well, I think as an author, I think it's hard to write in this moment without taking into account neuroscience. It is a development of our time. It tells us it's speculative, but the speculation is really smart, and it seems logically to tell us a lot about how our minds and bodies work. And one of the things that I really wanted to do by doing something physical as opposed to doing watercolors was to really understand my body, to embody life before my body broke down completely, to really kind of understand how my legs work. It sounds silly, but you know, there's my coach is constantly telling me to bend my knees, and I tell him, my knees are bent. He's like, no, they're not. Yes, they are. And then he shows me with his little phone dartfish, takes a little picture of me and says, look, your knees are not bent. And it feels like they're bent. And so there's just things, or the whole, when you're serving, making sure the racket dropped behind your back far enough, and it feels like it is, except when you get tensed up and then you stop doing that.
And right. And you had, there were times where you used data and you used video, and you really broke down your...
Well, I played at, there's a part of the book where I go down to Florida for a week to a camp, and I put myself through a regimen that a promising 12 or 13-year-old player would go through. And, I mean, what I learned there is I'm not an athlete in my 60s, and B, I would have never been an athlete in my teens. I mean, I would have never been an athlete in my teens because I was the shortest, skinniest kid in every class picture until I'm through high school. But I also didn't have that drive, that incredible focus that these kids have to become great. And they're not suffering illusions. They think they're going to be D1 tennis players, not pros. But boy, do they work hard. Ugh.
But you didn't. I know you've written a bit about the pro game elsewhere. The pro game wasn't a big focus of this. But I imagine when you're watching Djokovic return serve, or you're watching you're watching number 100 player hit with pace and accuracy. You have a
I love watching tennis, but I do believe that professional tennis players exist in a different world than we exist in. And I think this is true of all sports now in a way it wouldn't have been a generation or two ago. Where, I mean, if you watch the Tennis Channel and you watch a match that's being played in a women's match in the 70s, you can think, even if it's an illusion, you can think, this is a very, very highly refined version of the kind of game that I could play. When you're looking at the players who play today, they're playing at a different level. It's almost a different sport. They just happen to be playing it within the confines that we play in. But they're, they're hitting. They're just so much more athletic and so much more powerful. And so well trained. It's so that it is a different sport. I will say that if the one takeaway you might be able to get from professional tennis is to watch a good women's doubles match. You know, if you are a doubles player, and I think most amateurs are, you can watch Martina Hingis, how she moves and anticipates and gets herself in a position to volley that's different and better than
that's
yours.
I'm going to link the piece, the Week in Review piece you had that was sort of a prelude to this book. I don't think that gives away too much. I was talking about it with my mom, who is of a certain age. She had an interesting point, I thought, to sort of attack, defend, or modify this, that apart from all the benefits, sort of the secondary benefits, having a passion like this or having a new pursuit at a certain age, you're doing so much because it's good for you. So stretch because it does X, and eat kale because it does Y, and then blueberries are good for memory. Just doing something volitionally that you just want to do that isn't being done for any secondary health reason has real benefit.
I couldn't agree more with that. And I think, you know, that plus the idea that here is a narrative that at least for a while longer you get to control. You are setting this thing in motion. You are getting better at it, and you are getting more deeply into it. And it's a narrative that you have control of, that some of the other narratives that make up your life, you are ceding control of.
All right, let's take a quick break. This week on the SI Media Podcast, Richard Deitch welcomes the new voice of Monday Night Football. That's Sean McDonough, of course. He's taking over for Mike Tirico. Be sure to check out previous episodes as well, including Adnan Virk, or Adrian Virk, as people mispronounce it. He's the first Muslim anchor at ESPN, a Canadian, very versatile, actually knows his tennis as well. He was in here the other day, and we talked a bit of tennis. John Orand of Sports Business Daily has been a recent guest as well. Again, that's the SI Media Podcast, hosted by the inimitable Richard Deitch and his Twitter account. You can find it at si.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app of choice. That includes iTunes, Stitcher, and now Google Play Music. All right, media detour. We gave you a splashy intro, but apart from the New York Times Magazine, you also are the founder of Play, right?
I had the napkin.
That's a founder to me.
I had a back of the napkin sketch for Play. Mark Bryant came in and edited it and did an absolutely remarkable job. But I had an idea that there might be a space for a more literary sports magazine, and there have been those magazines over the years, and including yours. but there was not the. In the end, there was just not the. It was not. There was not a business model to keep it going. But it was fun while it lasted.
So the David Foster Wallace Federer piece comes in, though, which I think you could make a credible case as good a piece of sports writing as there's been.
I would say that too. Yeah.
You remember the first time you read that piece?
I do actually. I didn't know Dave except to say hello to him. But I stood with him while he Xeroxed that piece, which was, I think, about 140 pages long. He had big margins and space, and we stood there, and he had the bandana on the whole bit. And then he and Mark worked through the editing of it. I read it at a point when it was already edited, and there was a controversy because he wanted to maintain his serial commas, the comma that comes before and, which is not time style. He was serious about it. He said, well, I'm withdrawing the piece if I don't get to have these commas. And I had to go to Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, who had a lot more on his mind at that point than serial commas, and ask for permission to have the serial commas. And after an eye roll and an oy vey, he said, yeah.
There's some battles probably not worth fighting. Let's take a little media detour. I want to ask you three things. People can fast forward if they're not into this crazy game, but what do you think's the role of the magazine in media 2016?
That is a great question, and I don't really...
We ponder it every day here.
I don't have a definitive answer. One of the things I do suspect is going to develop is a return to print on a, maybe a quarterly or biannual nature, a sort of McSweeney's kind of magazine that's, kind of beautiful, coffee table object, maybe has only 20 or 25,000 readers, but they're willing to subscribe to it. And because there is something about a print magazine that's just, that experience of it, I think, is something that people still crave, just not a lot of people.
It's all, we're all trying to figure out this game. You get to write one tennis piece. It could be recreational, it could be personal, it could be a player you want to profile. What intrigues you these days? What's the tennis piece that is dying to be written that hasn't been?
The piece I would like to write, and actually I may get to write it. One of these, I've been approached by a magazine that calls itself Racket Magazine. That is starting up. It is one of these quarterly luxury magazines. And what I'd like to be able to write about is the most obscure tournament. I'd like to go to a tournament somewhere in China or a 250 level.
Not the wooden racket.
No. I mean a pro tournament and sort of imagine it. I could be wrong, but imagine that the people in this place don't quite know how to go to a tournament or go to a tennis tournament. And what's that like? And all the weird behavior that goes on and the silences that are enforced and all that. I'd really just love to see how that actually works and how the players feel about being in godforsaken, I don't know where. And
that's great.
That would be really fun for me.
I'm reading that. there was this whole push for China. And right. Some of it was because of Li Na, some of it was just everybody wants their beachhead.
Right.
And they would play this event in Shanghai. And the stadium was, an hour and a half from downtown, and they had a hard time drawing fans. But somebody said the best part was the media, who just had never covered an event like this, and they didn't know. They said, "Roger, you were lousy today. What do you say about that?" He said, this dumbfounded look on his face. But it's the same idea.
There's a whole etiquette
that goes with
that goes with this. That's been developed, over 100 years, and it is a sport with lots of, fussy etiquette, which I happen to think is good for the sport, for all kinds of reasons. I think it actually is a refreshing change from what you get when you go to a lot of other sporting events. But it does have its, its ticks and its rules and its manners, and that makes it special. I don't know.
Well, one thing I liked about, this is very crisply written. I don't know how much time you gave yourself, but this was three years. Yeah, this in a red like it. But it also struck me that you did not have that jaded tennis fandom where everybody has an idea of what can be improved and everyone's an idiot and the alphabet soup and the court's too big and we should play less. And I've never seen a sport with so many sort of carping critics that also love the sport that then close ranks with this criticism. But did you feel like you had to ward that off? Do you get caught up in how come I don't get Tennis Channel in Westchester?
That's a really interesting question. I think, for me, it's about maintaining fandom for as long and as deeply as you can. And I really learned this from my mentor, Roger Angel, who, the legendary baseball writer and New Yorker editor, and to try to always be looking at tennis as a fan and not a journalist in the way that if I were looking at the political system or something, I would look as a journalist. That to be a noticer and take it on its own terms and just really, kind of immerse myself in the joy and beauty of great tennis and take it for what it is. I'm sure there are improvements that could be made or changes that could be made. And the changes that have been made. I have no problem with a tie break. I have, there's things that I like the individual character of particular tournaments. I love that it's global and it moves around. I'm very much more a fan of the game than I am of an individual player. I love Roger Federer because he's the most beautiful player, and I love Rafa Nadal because he's one of the most intense competitors I have ever seen in any sport. And I love Djokovic, and I think he's underappreciated, actually. I think he may end up being the greatest player in any sort of measurable way there is, if he stays healthy and motivated, and he never plays in front of a crowd that that's rooting for him. So right. So I don't root for any of them individually, though I guess by mentioning those three, I am rooting for the fact that it's, as you well know, it's been a golden age for men's tennis right now.
But it sounds thoroughly logical to say that. You uh-huh. like Nadal, Federer. I can't imagine too many other, you know, I like Duke, Carolina, and Wake Forest. I like Hillary, Bernie, and Donald Trump.
I agree with that. I think, and also teams are maybe, you know, teams are tied to your locale, and but you know, I liked McEnroe and I liked Borg, and you know, I for different reasons, but it's always been how I felt about tennis.
No, I mean, I think that's unique to tennis that you can appreciate these rivalries and you don't have to. Right. No one's a Red Sox and a Yankees fan.
And you need the rivalries. I think one of the things that women's tennis is suffering from right now is that it doesn't have those rivalries. And Serena is unrivaled and has been for a while. And that's a weakness. We love those rivalries. And we get to watch them again and again and see how they alter their games and little slight nuances that change in order to come out on top.
You know what I was thinking? You just brought this up. We do this without notes, so this is a little bit scattered. But no, one of the themes of your book, I think, too, is that the math is changing on aging, and that as we're living longer, and science and nutrition is proceeding.
That's right.
Being in your early 60s now isn't what it was even a few years ago, and I think we're seeing that maybe mirrored a bit.
And yeah, I mean,
35-year-old still wouldn't slam.
This isn't in the book, but if you read John Updike's Rabbit novels, Rabbit Angstrom, by the time he turns, he's 61, he's on a golf course in Florida, and he's afraid he's having a heart attack golfing, right? He was a big smoker, which was, you know, part of his generation. It's different for us. If you're affluent, for sure, let's face it, there's a different math if you're affluent than if you're poor, and there's a different genetic math depending on, you know, whether you can dodge certain diseases and that. But yes, I mean, the overall vector is we're healthier longer. With professional tennis players, it's just the shape they have to be in and the strength they have to develop. You can't have that anymore at 16 years right. old. You know, they just are bigger, faster, better. And, you know, I think in all sports, the money is so much bigger that the motivation to stay in shape. I mean, you read, you know, McEnroe's books and all that. I mean, these were not guys like in you know, heavy workout training mode in Dubai heat in order to...
right, right.
To prepare themselves for the season. These guys eating cheeseburgers and staying up till 3 a.m. When you're talking about millions and millions of dollars that can potentially be made, that is a huge motivation, whether it's baseball or basketball or tennis, to keep yourself in shape.
Well, and then in tennis now, spread out over, you know, I think this Federer's 18th French Open.
Unbelievable.
So the window.
So he is, I think, a kind of, well, Djokovic may be too, but Roger Federer, his style is just so easy on his body. It's not the same for Rafa Nadal.
How are you, author question? How are you doing with your publicist here? How are you doing with the publicity phase, which I always find to be,
you know,
I'll prepare you for an interview.
Jeremy,
what made you want to write this book?
I'll say this. It's been easier than I thought it would be, partly because it's about myself. It's the first time I've ever written something in the first person. So it's just easier to talk about myself than it is to talk about a story that's just been published in the New York Times Magazine about Bosnia or something, where you're just, you're nervous about making sure you have all your facts right and whatever. It's just different when you're being asked about yourself, and it just sort of comes easier to me. So not so bad.
What's the state of your game?
I got hammered last night in a team doubles match. I'm a lefty, and it turns out even lefties hate playing lefties. And they were two lefties, and I just my muscle memory kept telling me I was actually hitting to their backhand when in fact I was hitting to their forehand.
It's hard. Right?
And so we lost 2-2. But so that's the, you know, that's the state of that. There's certain things I get better at. I think my backhand volley is better than it was a year ago. I really worked on that a lot over the winter. I enjoy the game so much, and knock on wood, it's not it makes me sore, but it doesn't make me injured. So that's the state of my game.
Great game, great book.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that was this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast with in-studio guest Jerry Maserati. Enjoyed that conversation a lot. I hope you did too. I'm John Wertheim. Our producer, as always, is the excellent Jamie Lasanti, a rising star in this media industry. We're going to try and get her to speak more on future podcasts. We will have another guest next week. It will be a French Open preview. And then I head to Roland Garros. We'll have some periodic dispatches from the 2016 French Open. Again, keep the suggestions coming. One of you suggested Dick Vitale, and we were able to get him the week before, and that was a tremendously fun podcast. We have other guests lined up, but again, suggestions welcome, critique welcome. Feel free to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, that's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. We'll do it again in 7 days. Have a good week, everyone.